Кракове грустил о Фатерланде, мечтал о философском диаманте и сомневался в собственном таланте. Он поднимал платочки женщин с пола, он горячился по вопросам пола, играл в команде факультета в полу, он изучал картежный катехизис и познавал картезианство сладость, потом полез в артезианский кладезь, эгоцентризма боевая хитрость, которой отличался Клаузевиц, была ему должно быть незнакома, поскольку Фатер был краснодеревец, Умбайшпиль бушевала глаукома, чума, холера, унд туберкулезен, он защищался Шварце папиросен, его влекли цыгане или мавры, потом он был помазан в бакалавры, потом снискал лиценциата лавры и пел студентам Кембри, динозавры, немецкий человек, немецкий ум, тем более когито эрго сум, Германия, конечно, über alles, в ушах звучит знакомый венский вальс, он с Краковым простился без надрыва и покатил на дрожках торопливо за кафедрой и честной кружкой пива. Сверкает в тучах месяц молодчина, огромный фолиант над ним мужчина, чернеет меж густых бровей морщина, в глазах арабских кружев чертовщина, в руке дрожит кордовский черный грифель, в углу его рассматривает в профиль арабский представитель Мефи бен Стофель. Пылают свечи, мышь скребет под шкафом. Гердоктор полночь, я вальшлафен, шлафен. Две черных пасти произносят мяу. Неслышно с кухни входит идиш фрау. В руках ее дрожит омлет со шпеком. Гердоктор чертит адрес на конверте. Год штрафа Ингланд, Лондон, Франсис Бэкон. Приходят и уходят мысли черти. Приходят и уходят гости годы, потом не вспомнить платья, слов, погоды. Так проходили годы шито-крыто. Он знал арабский, но не знал санскрита. И с опозданием гей было открыто. И майны клайны фройляйн Маргарита. Тогда он написал в Каир депешу, в которой отказал он черту душу. Приехал Меф, и он переоделся, он в зеркало взглянул и убедился, что навсегда теперь переродился. Он взял букет и в будуар девицы отправился ундвени в виде вицы. Их либе ясность, я, их либе точность, их бин просить не видеть здесь порочность. Ви намекает, что он любил цветочниц, их понимает, что даст изганце срочность. Но это сделал Камахдер Гроссе минус. Диточно шпрах и Махдер Гроссе синус. Душа и сердце на энгехапт на вынос. От человека алес ждать напрасно. Остановись мгновенье, ты прекрасна. Меж нами дьявол ходит ежечасно. И поминутно этой фразы ждет. Однако человек, mein lieber Herrn, настолько в сильных чувствах не уверен, что поминутно лжет, как сивый мерин, но словно Гёте маху не дает он, Гроссер Дихтер Гёте дал описку, чем весь сюжет подверг Аганце риску, и Томас Манн сгубил свою подписку. А Шер Гуно смутил свою артистку. Искусство есть искусство, есть искусство. Но лучше петь в раю, чем врать в концерте. Дикюнст гехабт потребность в правде чувства. В конце концов, он мог бояться смерти. Он точно знал, откуда взялись черти. Он съел дердог в бензине и в галене. Он мог дозваться рассушить в колене, и возраст мог он указать в полене. Он знал, куда уходят звезд дороги. Но доктор Фауст нихц не знал о Боге. Есть мистика, есть вера, есть Господь. Есть разница между них и есть единство. Одним вредит, других спасает плоть. Не верь, если слепота, а чаще свинство. Бог смотрит вниз, а люди смотрят вверх. Однако интерес у всех различен. Бог органичен, да, а человек должно быть ограничен. У человека есть свой потолок, держащийся вообще не слишком твердо, но в сердце льстец отыщет уголок, и жизнь уже видна не дальше черта. Таков был доктор Фауст, таковы Марло и Гёте, Томас Манн и Масса, певцов, интеллигентов, унд, увы, читателей в среде другого класса. Один поток сметает их следы, их колбы, Донерветтер, мысли, узы. И дай им Бог успеть спросить, куды, и услыхать, что следом крикнут музы. А честный немец сам Дервек Цюрюк не станет ждать, когда его попросят. Он Вальтер достает из теплых брюк и навсегда уходит в Вальтер Клозет. Фрулайн, скажите, вас издаст инкубус? Инкубус, das ist eine kleine Globus. Noch großer Dichter Goethe, задал ребус. Und ewig вы злые журавли, из Веймарского выпорхнув тумана, ключ выхватили прямо из кармана, и не спасла нас зоркость Эккермана, и мы теперь матрозен на мели. Есть истинно духовные задачи, а мистика есть признак неудачи в попытке с ними справиться иначе. Их бы не стоит это толковать, цумбайшпиль, потолок, преддверие крыши, поэмой больше, человеком Ницше. Я вспоминаю Богоматерь в нише, обильный фриштик, поданный в кровать. Опять септембр, скука, полнолунье, в ногах мурлычет серая колдунья, а под подушку положил колунья. Сейчас бы шнапсу, это Абгемахт. Септембр, яволь, портится характер, буксует в поле трахтящий трактор, и хлебе жизнь, и фёльки жбёбахтер. Гуднахт, май либерн, я гуднахт.
Супер. Да, с нами был Иосиф Бродский. Его произведение «Два часа» читал автор.
Окей. So for those of you who've come in since the intros, you know, we're basically going to be sharing this panel conversation live in Bethlehem, but also we'll be archiving it for people to learn about the different perspectives and actions that have been shared later. This is also about popular education and sort of also celebrating and recognizing the moments where we do take collective action, because I think this is often one of the really huge ways that social movements are criminalized. It's not just in the moment, but it's also in how our own collective memory is often sort of washed away in narratives where social action and collective action is not a part of the sort of historical depiction. You know, whether it's, you know, going back to you know, movements that opposed the Israeli invasion and besiegement of Beirut in 1982. We know that in Amsterdam and in Brussels and London and all over the world, there was massive organizing that took place at that time to stand with people as they struggled against.
I just don't go live because it happens.
Okay, great. And if maybe okay, so we'll go live. You just signal. Thank you so much. Okay, so yeah, there's a lot of layers of, but you know, it's a grassroots experiment. why not? Okay, so. I think that one thing that comes to mind, you know, when we're here together in Amsterdam, gathered to talk about action and art, is that refusal to basically be silent, right? And so in this time of genocide, I think one of the things that often happens when we think about the role of art in social movements is that it's seen that this is a moment where art should be paused, you know, where artistic expression and collective creative action is actually central to social movements and is central to taking action, right? If we think about banner drops, if we think about protests themselves, they're often about reimagining the city and reimagining our relationship to space and what is possible in space. If we think about the student encampments, the free universities, that took place here in Amsterdam, but also all over the world, there was a creative reimagination of what is possible in these moments. We know that there were lending libraries, poetry workshops, direct action trainings, language workshops at the Gaza Solidarity Encampment in Montreal, where I live. There were all those things that took place as part of the encampment. And that sort of zone that is opened up in these moments of crisis is a creative space, right? And I think often art institutions often push us to think about art as only being understood in a certain box, which is often a box that very much commercializes what the creative practice is. And erased from that whole thing is the whole reality of creativity in social movements. So my question to you all would be, if you could just talk about that, because often in moments of crisis, we're sort of pushed towards not thinking about the importance of creative expression, of arts, as central to social movement organizing. But, you know, as you've all illustrated, in your tangible lived experience in the past year, art and creative expression has been central to a lot of the both direct actions, collective actions, and also the opening of space to think about radical differences of possibility in terms of how institutions relate to these structures of power that are enabling and supporting genocide in terms of the relationship between institutions and the Israeli state. So if you have any maybe specific examples of how creativity and art has been part of the collective experiences you've been part of in the past year in the Palestine Solidarity Movement. So we could just maybe start on this side. You could just share your thoughts. We are live in Palestine, in Bethlehem on Radio Hara, here from OT301 in Amsterdam. Welcome.
For me, I guess then, we're handing over. So I'm a community printer, and we're giving people space to express something about which is that is happening for them. And the art practice, I think, is then coming from the community. It's like somebody who wants to go and do something and put it out there, we give them a platform or a space or literally a printer to go and print something which they want to put out there. And for me, it's not then about what they put out. I have people who came and print watermelons, which I think is quite funny or interesting that we print watermelons in the Netherlands where you're not restricted to print actually quite radical things. But I don't care what somebody prints or wants to put out there. Like, for me, it's impactful that someone wants to make sense of this for themselves by making some sort of image and then take action in that way. So it's just a means for me to, like, put something out there and to be active. And then what they make next, who knows? So that's what I think has been really, really nice to see, that people want to go and do something. And it doesn't have to be perfect, and it doesn't have to align with my personal politics. It does, but like not in the way that I would put it out there, mm-hmm. or put something out there.
So you're underlining the process in a sense.
Yeah, and to give space that, well, I mean, for me, like, making art doesn't belong to an art institution, it belongs to people. And where I come from, actually, everybody is involved with making art in like working class backgrounds in Britain. I think everybody really does make art. And in art institutions, you don't see these voices, but the type of art that these people make is often like grime music or rap music. And you see that in working class culture in the Netherlands as well. People are really busy like expressing something about powerful systems and about capitalism or about the prison system or about something which has harmed them. But it looks like grime music, or it looks like something which is a little bit different to what you're going to find in big art institutions. And right. For me, that's really powerful, right. That somebody wants to go and do this. Mm-hmm. And so in a similar sense, what I've come across is that people who just want to make something and express it, and if they get started on this, then that's really beautiful that they can do something and then something happens next in this.
Yeah, like I think as a Palestinian artist, since I arrived here as a refugee, like from like Syria, I grew up in a refugee camp in Damascus. I noticed that my classmates, like, or my school, like, they just don't know anything about Palestine. And, like, they just have no idea. Also, one of my classmates, like, went to Tel Aviv for vacation, you know, and they just didn't know how to feel about it. Like, it's like, coming from Palestine but never been there, not being allowed, like we were like our right to go back home was taken away from us, being stateless my whole life. But what was interesting that my teacher, when I told him like I grew up in a refugee camp from in Damascus, he was like, oh, you are from like your grandparents from the Nakba generation, like, and that was fascinating for me, like my art like school teacher, like he knew a lot, and like we had amazing discussions. So he pushed me like to kind of kind of educate people about Palestine, and that was a long time ago when I was like 25, like 10 years ago. So my art practice is basically about like diaspora, like war, conflict, identity crisis, and belonging. So in that last year, like I just kept doing what I'm doing, and. There's a lot of learning to be done here within like the art practice or with like the academy itself, like, well, like everywhere. So I was one of those artists who got like a lot of overwhelming actually invitations, like to kind of participate in like a performance for Palestine or like art discussion or like artist talk, like whatever. But on the other hand, like the you know, museums or like big institutions wouldn't invite me like to do like anything for Palestine. So it was like a smaller spaces, like alternative spaces where like communities are gathering like to be there together for Palestine and for like learning and understanding what's happening and how to show solidarity and what's the possible ways. So I think like. In the Netherlands, like there is like a lot of those small, beautiful communities, and what's happening is really amazing. Like to see that there is a space like for us within, like even if it's like smaller spaces, but it is like also shameful, like to see the amount of silencing of Palestinian artists or pro-Palestinian voices, like within the larger institution. What was the question?
Well, that's great. I mean, these are examples of, you know, your presence and your role as an artist here in Amsterdam. And I think, you know, one thing that often has happened is that separation between art and social action, or art and social movements. But in the experience that you know, you've all pointed to, on the ground, whether it's in your own personal practice or in collective initiatives, that separation doesn't really exist, right? Art is often a tool to to lift up and to speak to the issues of our time, which is, and that's mirrored in cities all around the world. And I think this moment that has lifted up the urgency of solidarity with Palestine has really underlined that, the role of creative expression in this, in these moments. So if you have anything to add on this point, please do. Yeah.
Not like,
yeah, okay.
I mean, I think it's interesting what you said, but it's also, you brought something up which was very important, which is the fact that there is, of course, creative expression, and there is like a lot of drive to make within these sort of like grassroots,
yeah,
or smaller spaces and so on in Amsterdam and the Netherlands.
Yeah.
But then there's the art world,
yeah,
and there you have a bit of a break. Like, museums don't really express solidarity in the same way. Individual artists who have a practice, who are tied to museums, don't really do the same. So there is a bit of a disconnect between,
yeah,
the art world and art making and creative expression in relation to solidarity for Palestine, which is important to bring up, because a lot of artists that have tried to show solidarity have also felt a bit like left out of the general field, because it requires, I think what showing solidarity requires is to like deny your individuality a bit, because you are part of something bigger than yourself. You're trying to do something which is not for your own self, for your own promotion, for your own practice. It goes beyond that. So then you have to leave that behind. And the way in which we are trained as artists in the Netherlands is very individualistic. It is very much based on your individual trajectory through whatever. And you have to show something which is original and yourself and so on and so forth. And when you cannot do that because you're trying to actually do work in solidarity with a cause that you care about, then you end up being a bit conflicted individually and a bit left out. Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of things to unpack there, I guess.
Yeah, I think for me, at least, like, this idea of individual art and collective art is definitely something that I've been trying to grasp since the beginning of the genocide. I come from the film world, and coming from the film world, it somehow, maybe you lie to yourself, but you kind of tell yourself, okay, yeah, I've been working for about 10 to 15 years in specifically like the documentary film world, which means that it's supposed to be people that strive for caring about certain causes or certain social change or equality, and you position yourself, or at least I did, one step inside of institutions and one step outside, and trying to find that balance between, okay, participating within grander institutions or film festivals, or you know, because that's where discourse is happening, and that's where opportunities to reach out to public is happening. And then you're one step outside because you're like, I'm looking at you from the outside, and first of all, you've got an accessibility problem. You know, who's participating in the access to this art? Who is actually going and seeing those films? Are we not ending up in this little bubble where we're all talking to each other and we all agree with each other, and then the people who don't agree with us are a little bit on the outside and we don't engage in any conversation with them? And you know, the first thing that is very clear, whether it's museums or film festivals, and for me at least, is like class limitations, and that has happened with, you know, neoliberal practices since the 60s, where art has become gatekept in those institutions. So before, it used to be that those institutions would go into the communities, would go into spaces where artists were quite marginalized, and pick up what they needed. And then, you know, there's the process of museumification, you know, so taking them and then tagging it as art. But nowadays, it's more like, oh, we're doing And it's not that it didn't exist even like before. Artists were always like also petitioned to say, okay, yeah, you're going to paint me as the king of this shit country. Okay, great. And then I'll pay you and then you do that. But today, I mean, it's quite something because you have really, oh, I really want to talk about this subject that's hot now. And so I'm going to use you and like, let you tell your story so that I can tell it better on top of you. So it's like this really like the center and the margins and this relation of bringing in people from the margins into the center that's quite abusive and colonial. I've had quite a bit of distance that got established, at least on my part, from institutional art. And as you mentioned, like at the beginning, I think, yeah, it's crazy how art gets created in protests, in banners, in flyers, in communication with people, what chants sound like and how people get creative about it, what the banging of the drums sound like when people are marching. And those are fantastic things. And I think that also paint, when it's splattered on buildings that are very, very romantic and that are very complicit, can make very beautiful expressionist, art. I think barricades are really beautiful and very intricate. They take a lot of, community, thinking about space and it's a practice. So those things I've been quite excited about in terms of art. Maybe one last thing is that my mother is a teacher and she teaches children with disability who had a day where they were necessarily speaking about their neurodivergency. And they had a whole wall where they were allowed to paint on it, and that is in Saudi Arabia, where any sign of solidarity with Palestine is being really censored. And those children have a range of age from 4 years old to about 16. And the whole wall was filled with Palestinian flags, watermelons, Free Palestine, Love to Gaza. Most of them also miswrote Palestine, and it was quite cute and to see it. But yeah, that was, my mom sent me this and I thought, wow, fantastic mural, this is, this couldn't be in public space and like really take art outside of those institutions and put it again on the streets and in public discourse, public arena for people to see. Yeah.
Yeah, I think what we're talking about is really this difference between institutions or institutionalization on the one hand and like people creating stuff on the other for different purposes. And obviously there's a huge chasm between these things going on, which I think is like reflects something more like broader. In the Netherlands, most people are obviously against the genocide in Gaza, like the majority, the public opinion is not like that set on Israel doing whatever it's doing. People are not that politicized, but they're against the genocide. But our government and the politicians and the institutions that we have are very staunchly pro-Israel. So there's a huge, huge difference there, and it's turning out to become more and more difficult in this country, and I think in most so-called Western democracies, for the people to actually influence their governments or their states to reflect what they truly want. I think this is a general problem that is structuring our societies. There's a breakdown there, basically, or at least potentially. And I think something of this is also reflected in the way institutions, art institutions, culture institutions, relate to what people are actually doing. What are the most pressing matters at hand? Is my mic working? Yeah. I think this is an important dilemma. I think to reflect on, but I think it should maybe it's should maybe lead us to think about this relationship a bit differently. And for instance, not really think about, you know, like what's going on during protest or this free creativity that we're engaged in as art. You know, it's not something that we should fetishize, I think, as, I don't know, like one activity that is more important than others. I think what happens during in moments of protest that are as liberatory as the ones that we've been experiencing. I mean, liberatory, I'm talking about the student intifada at the university campus. And I think on occasions like that, what really happens is not so much that now we're using art as a tool to express something. It's more by... Yes. I think it's rather the case that by reclaiming space in that sense, and then relating to each other in a different way than we're used to, that certain capacities that we have are set free, and we can act differently. And I think that's the important thing. That's what David Graeber called social creativity. Which is a deep, deep capacity that we as human beings have, all of us. You don't need to be a professional artist for it. You don't need to be anything. Also because it doesn't matter and at that moment of revolt or revolution or protest, like different things become important. Turns out that it is important to be able to build barricades very well or very quickly or to organize food supplies or be a street medic. Like all these things that have nothing to do with your, I don't know, professional identity or the way that you were trained, these things become important. And I think that is indeed a type of creativity in the sense that it's it goes to show that the capacities or the abilities that we have as human beings, they become truly liberated once we relate to each other in a different way, which I think is one of the most important purposes of protest to begin with. That's really what we're doing, that's really what's happening. That's what changing the world is, I think. But that means that like the more radically we do that, the more differently, I think, the more different the meaning becomes of what it is that we create and why, and art, for instance. So, I mean, one of the things that I was thinking about during the student intifada in Amsterdam when all the barricades were being built, which is quite an uncommon thing in Amsterdam. We don't really have a barricading tradition here in this city. No, I mean, not really.
Not anymore.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, you were saying it was like in the 80s, it was a while back. So it's really quite uncommon, and I was maybe think about a country where they do have a tradition with making barricades, France, and I was thinking about the Paris Commune and reading up on what was going on then, and what is one of the interesting things about the Commune is that they took over the city of Paris, the insurgents, the revolutionaries, they destroyed all hierarchies. Or they tried to at least to become radically democratic, you know, like the city was being run by the workers themselves, and it had an impact on how they viewed art. So they were thinking that art was important to what they were doing, but it was, but like the really important thing for them was to change what the meaning of art was. So for them, it was not anymore about making beautiful objects that could then be, I don't know, like enjoyed by watching them. It was, the purpose was to create what they called communal luxury. They were gonna infuse their everyday life, the streets, their barricades, whatever, with art. And that was the point. And everybody could do it. Nobody needed to be an artist to contribute to this type of creativity. And I think the important thing is that this is entirely impossible if not related to revolutionary activity. And I think that's an important thing. That's the thing that we need to think about when we think about this relation between art and politics. And it's not so much about can art be a tool for this. It's more we're trying to change the way that we relate to each other. We're trying to change our societies. And like whatever resources we have available or we find in ourselves should be part of that. And then what we're really doing is creating a different world.
I just wanted to add that the things that you say also are the things that I've learned as being an art student. I mean, when you have this sort of like protective bubble around you and materials and like all these sort of like things that you can not just build barricade with, but like also creatively express yourself, and all these communal moments that you have to like come together, reflect on things, and so on and so forth. Those are the perfect, I mean, as an artist, you are trained to be a revolutionary. It's just the problem is that's not necessarily valued within your education. Other things are valued. Making objects that you can sell, that you can present at the end of the year, that's what's valued. But all the social layer of like education is not treasured for what it is. Because that, I mean, I think an art school is the perfect place to foster revolutionary potential. Which, and you could also see it because there was the student encampments, which were quite temporary, but then there was also the student occupation in an art academy in Amsterdam, in Rietveld, which took 40 days. And there you could really see creative expression in an artistic context of an art academy that continued, and it also had the layer of community because people had to like live there, feed each other, take care of each other, have fights, learn how to deal with them, and so on. Like, all this social layer was there. And it also had a beautiful, like, yeah, layer on top of art. Yeah, anyway, so it's a matter of, like, kind of indeed reconfiguring what we value, but the tools are already there. Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. So, I mean, one thing that I feel a lot of what was just shared underlines is how we relate to what power values versus what social movements and what collective action values. And I think one of the challenges that has been made very clear this past year around the Palestine Solidarity Movement is how is sort of a ringing question that we probably all have, and it's phrased in different ways, is something around well, how long do we just appeal to power with, you know, what our demands are, justice, liberation, the end of colonization in Palestine, and what has been made very clear if we're talking, you know, across the board from the political class to corporations of the military-industrial complex that are benefiting economically from this war to art institutions, we're always put in this position where you know, the tradition has been in the Western context is to appeal to power and try to appeal to some sense of morality and power. But the power that we've seen this last year has not been in that. It's been in collective actions, and it has been in those group expressions of you know, other worlds, as we were talking about, right? You know, whether it's student encampments, whether it's street art practices, that are saying the things that you're not allowed to say in a lot of institutions, if we're talking about media institutions, to talk about, you know, the Zionist project as a fundamentally unacceptable colonial initiative of Western Europe, period. And so I just wanted to sort of look at this question of, you know, whether it's in the art world or worlds or other in other contexts, is how do we break... And if you have any sort of thoughts about that, of breaking that cycle of always trying to appeal to power. Because, you know, how long do we have to sort of appeal to celebrity A or celebrity B, you know, to not play a concert in Tel Aviv? Personally, it doesn't really matter. What matters is, it matters that they are doing it, and it should not happen, period. But what is important also is what we're doing, right, as social movements, as artists who are part of those social movements, right? And, you know, there's been so much really important, you know, talk this past year about pushing cultural institutions to boycott. Let us also underline that in the global South, if we go back to the 60s and 70s, boycott was the norm for talking about the Israeli state. If we're talking about South Africa, we're talking about, you know, progressive Latin American contexts. If we're talking about North Africa, this was the norm, this global solidarity against colonialism, right? And in the story of talking about boycott today, it's often always sort of so Western-centric, right? And left out of that picture is the global South movement of, you know, pan-national solidarity against colonialism, you know, which also extends to projects that were, like the Yugoslavian context, or if we look to India,
you know, Palestine solidarity was just a part of an understanding of the world, which I think also is part of thinking about representation in these spaces and what stories are told or not told. So any thoughts about this sort of critical take on challenging this tendency that power pushes us towards, to always want to, you know, to sort of push us towards appealing to power versus celebrating our own power and looking to alternative histories of what power has looked like from other vantage points, from other worlds.
I think, you know, we can look at ourselves as a society that has gradients, right? So some people are more, we're not all in the same place or pushing the same fight at the same time. I think that for me, coming from Lebanon and from Palestine and having done quite a lot of connection to my grandfather, for instance, who was a resistance fighter as well, we understand an anti-colonial or decolonial thought that tells you over and over again, you know, the oppressor is never gonna, you know, leave you alone. It's not about them being convinced. It's not about you pleading your case to them. It is not about begging them or trying to show your humanity. You have to take what's yours. And in order for you to do that, you need to figure out what your tools are. Because of you being colonized, your tools were also colonized. And what was ripped away from you was this ancestral knowledge, was taking care of your land, was resisting in the way that your ancestors have done before you. And it is then put in your mind that you can resist with the tools of the oppressor. And that's just not going to happen. And I think that at least the way that I see it now is that, like, really Palestine is at the vanguard or at the beginning of so many different causes that lead us all together, that bring us all together to understand that we do live under capitalism. We don't exist outside of it. So therefore, when we're talking about social change, I believe that economic pressure is the thing that hurts people. And we're talking, what, 1 week after Barclay divested from Elbit Systems, and that happened because of the art, you know, and all the paintings that happened to their buildings due to PAL action in the UK. And we're talking about, you know, being hit for 65 times. It cost them a shit ton of money to repair and to remove that art. And they can divest contracts with weapon factories that are completely, like, ingrained in the genocide in Palestine right now, in Gaza. And so, yeah, I think when it comes to art, we need to also figure out a way how to make them lose the comfort that they found in themselves, in this normalizing aspect of being so fucking okay with having your hands splattered in blood and you participating in a genocide. I wish we lived in a world where the world stopped when bombs fell on Gaza, but it doesn't, you know? So I think, yeah, economic pressure for me.
For me, I mentioned that, I mean, I'll also like add to what you said in the sense of, I don't think you can like dismantle the master's house or the master's tools, but you do need to know what the tools of the master are. Because sometimes you need to use those against them a little bit and then deflect and then go sideways and then, you know, yeah, zigzag across so that you can, the tools we used, like I mentioned, were very boring tools in like breaking ties with the Israeli Art Academy. They were tools of petitions and meetings and blah, blah, meeting notes and like asking for transparency and doing assemblies and so on. But in using those tools, which sometimes meant also like breaking our heads in two, because during every meeting we had with our management of our art academy, we were being gaslit in real time. Like, if we wouldn't have taken notes during our meetings, we would have probably felt like we would be in another reality watching what the communication would be after every meeting. But then, yeah, basically from those boring tools, we managed to finally figure out that the problem with our management in our art academy was that they had no idea what they were talking about. So we were present, we listened, we tried our best, and then we figured out, like, we unmasked their hypocrisy in real time. They didn't know what they were talking about. And we, what we were trying to ask them was to break ties, but they didn't understand what that means. They didn't stand for anything. So they couldn't really make a decision until we also brought enough tools inside from our own side to educate them as to what this actually means. So yes, you take the tools from them, which is bureaucratic tools, but you also use your tools of teaching them and opening their eyes to what is actually happening. Never assume, I think, that the master knows what the fuck they're talking about. Do not do that. And demand things, but don't expect them to fully understand. And yeah, sometimes you have to repeat it and explain it and open up. And yeah, at least that was my experience. Don't also spend too much time on that, maybe. I think we were lucky, like I mentioned, we were lucky to break ties in between many more, like, people that put their, like, actual bodies on the line in other places. Yeah, but we did indeed appeal to authority in order to ask for permission when we shouldn't have always done that. But I think our win at the time helped others also get a bit propelled.
And for people who don't know, what was the win?
The win was breaking ties with an Israeli art academy called Betzalel from Jerusalem. And it's basically our art academy had exchange ties, which were not even active. So all we were asking for was for them to make a statement that they're going to break these ties, because due to the war, the ties, no one can go on exchange right now anywhere in that part of the world. But we also asked during all these negotiations to offer scholarships for Palestinian students, to allow fundraisers within the Art Academy, because people have tried to do fundraisers before that and they were denied, to allow people to put, like, proofs of solidarity within the Art Academy, also denied. Posters were being taken down by facilities. There was a lot of, like, this sort of everyone fearing for their own self-expression. What else? To also make ties with Palestinian art academies. So, like, both positive things and, like, things that meant breaking of ties, but in general to allow a conversation to happen on this topic. Yeah, and I think that was very important at the end of the day. Yes?
Yeah, I think this year what I have learned a lot about, like, marginalized groups, that they all, like, felt the pain of what's happening in Palestine. Like, I am part of Sexy Landlord and No Limits Art Castles. Like, it's like a beautiful community where a lot of oppressed groups, like, come there to express their, like, needs, let's say. So what was happening that all these communities, like queer, transgender, like refugees, disabled people, sex workers, all of them are like really standing and incredible, showing incredible solidarity for Palestine. And I learned that these are the people I need to surround myself with, you know, like when I go to art fair, like, it's just boring and I have to keep doing that, like, just for my career, somehow career, like, to hopefully to sell, to grow, like, to go further, like, with my life. But at the end, like, I feel safer, I feel better in those smaller communities where people are, they really care for you. And I think I still go, like, to those, like, bigger institution events, like, and stuff like this, and hope to change from within somehow. I don't have the tools yet. It's still, like, a very long journey because everything is so shocking, like, and disturbing what's happening. But yeah, like, as an example, like, I participated at Art Rotterdam, like, the prospects from Mondrian Fonds this year. And we just did a whole demonstration within the art fair, like, everyone was wearing kufia and the Palestinian flags, and we were screaming at the whole art there. and everyone was walking around with champagne and like trying to buy art, and then we came and so that was funny, that was amazing. Like it was like very, very confronting, like for rich Western people who are trying to shop art, like to just like to buy art, to see a demonstration like this. And I think like it is amazing to disturb a moment of this, like, because you, yeah, because like some people just like they don't care, they don't want to see, they don't want to hear, and then like you they suddenly have to see it, even within their own like comfort zone, like of like, oh, I'm here like to do some shopping, like buy some art, and, like nice thing for my nice house, and then this nice demonstration started. So like stuff like this, I think it's like really important to just think about how to change from within, and it's really a big question for me that I'm trying to find answers for.
I wanted to speak to what was said earlier by Barkey about like one of the ways in which we take power is to sort of is to disrupt the economic imperatives which rule us, or sort of, you know, rule over moral sentiments almost, and borrowing from Paul Gilroy. It's like some of those words. And I also want to speak to this idea of taking power in a couple of different ways. So like, I really like one of the things we're doing is to own the means of production and power and putting out images and really having that. Because Facebook really, and like these Meta, yeah, these people are going to censor us and they're going to stop us. And I think a lot of nice things come in these spaces, but in the end, if we own it ourselves and can put things out ourselves, then we have the power to put out what we want. Malcolm X talks about this, that, you know, the first thing you want to take is the radio towers. In the 1960s, actually now we want to take other means of putting out images and sound, or, you know, like narrative.
Printing
is, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the other part of this, which I think is really interesting, is like the perverseness of the media and the perverseness of actually of Instagram feeds and social media feeds in how we are pictured in this.
Yeah.
Like a few years ago, I saw an 8.5 minute video of George Floyd being murdered by a police officer. And there are really, really like often shared images of people of color in situations of distress or suffering. Mm-hmm. That's how we're shown very often. And it's because actually the thing which really speaks to power for me is to see us in situations of, is to see people of color in images of power.
Yeah.
That's not going to be shown. Like, I'm from an Indian background, and the image which is shown from Indian independence is an image of Mahatma Gandhi in a dhoti doing a salt mine walk. And that happened. But also the images which are on our walls are images of Chandrashekhar Azad and Bhagat Singh and Mala Sen and people with guns and like actually standing there. But actually power is really scared of us, I think. And so these images do not get perpetuated or shown by certain, even Western activists and liberals, because it's really threatening to see like an image of maybe an Arab person or a brown person with a fucking gun in their hands. Because then in that moment, like, I'm not under rubble and my body is not in blood and in tatters. We're not just images to be we're not only vulnerable, we're also resilient and we're also powerful. But that, I think, is the thing that people are most scared of. I think you feel it here in some way. People know, like, actually in where we live here, like Amsterdam especially is like Disneyland, right? Like you like the hours of labor and the oppression of people and the wasted life of people here, like you really I think you can feel it with how glossy the space is.
Mm.
Because can feel that this rests on something, and we know it's over there, and we know it's coming. Our governments are really consistent with this. They really spend a lot of money on these walls. So like this, but like this image of a person of color in power, that's what I really wanted to put out there, and it's about them taking power back of the narrative as well. It's really interesting to me that like Black Lives Matter really launched in 2020. It's a really perverse thing to happen then. You know, because actually it starts in 2012 with the murder of Eric Garner. Have I said that right? Is it Eric Garner?
In 2020.
No, in 2012 it starts with the murder of Eric Garner under Obama. But in 2020 it was like the perverseness of the media cycle because they were bored of something like Corona. Then they really took off. So, there's a perverseness also that we are sometimes interacting with.
Can I comment that?
Yes.
I've been rereading the autobiography of Assata Shakur, and actually this idea of printed press of strong black women was exactly the narrative that the FBI used in order to justify then the haunting, hunting her down, right? There's an image of someone stealing a bank, and then they write it down as in, you know, this is Assata Shakur, she stole this bank, there's a price for you or for her head, like, bring her, you know, we're going to imprison her. And that justified the whole discourse of how Assata Shakur was followed by this media, a spectacle around her image and these printed posters of her face with wanted on top of them. And at the same time, the trials were happening and she kept on being not guilty in all the fucking trials. And yet what sticked in people's memories is that Assata Shakur was one of the most wanted women in the United States, and so the FBI was targeting her in that way. And I think, like, if I refer back to the Palestinian liberation movement today, I think in the West, normalization of Palestinian resistance in the 60s and in the 70s is quite easy and quite accepted. So, like, images of Leila Khaled or images of the Fida'iyin in the 60s and in the 70s have become part of, like, something that is, I'm not saying mainstream, but it is quite acceptable. However, when you want to talk about resistance fighters today, if you want to look at the axis of resistance today, images that are coming out of Gaza of freedom fighters, whether they belong to Hamas or to the Islamic Resistance Movement or to the Hezbollah or to the Yemeni fighters, all those images are being in the making now, and yet they're being boycotted and censored right away because of throbs of terrorism, because of throbs of the power being afraid of people of color having resistance and having, you know, might and force to say, hey, I know you are killing us, but do you think we're only sitting here waiting for you to kill us while we cry? No, we are fighting you back. And I think those images really need to be, like, flooding our streets and being part of that discourse, yeah.
I just wanted to say that as you were talking about this, I keep thinking about what happened yesterday in Amsterdam and the way in which the media narrative kind of even goes against this, like, this level of, like, resistance, which is not on the level of resistance that you have in Palestine, but it's still any sort of resistance and any sort of fighting back against being basically bullied on the street if you wear anything in solidarity with Palestine is completely shut down on the level of government, police, mayor, everything else. I find that absolutely fucking fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, in a bad way.
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that they really want to, make sure that resistance is futile. You know, they don't want any kind of eruption of protest or revolt to spiral into something bigger, and for it to gain traction and wide popular support. Like, they're dead set on preventing that from happening. Barkley, we were just talking about this before this broadcast, right? Like, that at the student encampments in Amsterdam in that time, that the repression was basically, it was a lot swifter and harsher than most of us expected. They came immediately, like on the same day, with bulldozers and like dozens and dozens of riot cops to smash it immediately before it could, like, become something that they weren't able to control. I think that is a major difference between our time and maybe a couple of decades ago, which you were talking about, Stefan. I'm not entirely sure why that is, except that maybe that those in power, the imperialist powers, they have the capacity to learn from these earlier mobilizations that happened. And I think maybe one of the things that we that can be done or that we can do against that is to remember. That's perhaps one thing. Bucky, you were talking about and Adili as well, about these images of Laila Khaled united, like Indian resistance against British rule. Like we need to remember that this happened and understand that this is a tradition that also exists and that we can try and become part of now in our moment. I think that's an important thing. I think, you know, like the radical left in Amsterdam has always been pro-Palestinian. And I mean, it's not like most people are part of that scene or movement, but I think it's not without reason that these protests here that happened here were so severe. There's this tradition of